Welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Dr. Gregory Eastwood, and we've been talking about medical, or actually enhancements in general, and how they might affect our health and the whole ethics and morals involved in this. It's, in other words, what's right or wrong with enhancing our bodies and our minds. Dr. Eastwood, you know, we've been... For so long, in the last probably 20 years, there's been all of these cosmetic interventions where we could literally change the way we look, breast implants for one, and a little more kind of controversial topic might even be sexual changes. Mm-hmm. So that's a whole other area where using enhancements raises a lot of this kind of ethical and moral, these moral questions.
Yeah, but the common denominator of what we're talking about today is that it all resolves back to how people feel about these matters and their own value systems, and whether, you know, some people sex changes are perfectly appropriate, to others it's abhorrent. And we see this played out in the political arena as well.
And that's where the law comes in and where our policies come in, and that's a whole other arena, because law and policy, public policy, are determined by the public good, one would hope, as opposed to lobbies.
That's the idea, that the law should reflect the collective ethic, basically, or moral stance of the populace.
Right.
But we know that in a diverse population such as ours, the law is always going to be contrary, or at least some laws, always going to be contrary to some people's personal beliefs.
Right, especially in a country like ours where we value personal freedom so much and democracy and this whole notion of, you know, the right of the individual as opposed to the good, the public good. And I'll never forget that statement about you can't cry fire in a crowded theater, even though we have freedom of speech, which we fight very, very arduously to protect.
Right.
So getting to that notion, using that notion, We are with the Human Genome Project. We are on the really on the precipice of what could be a very slippery slope. This whole notion of manipulating our genes to for an effect, for some, as you said, culturally valued effect. So, talk about that. How are genomics being used these days? I do know there's always the potential for abuse.
That's right. Well, the Human Genome Project was concluded in 2003, 2 years ahead of schedule and under budget, one of the amazing feats of humankind, one might say. And what it did was to show us what the genes are in the, you know, in our chromosomes. What it did not do is to explain what each of those genes does, and also there are certain genes that are mutants, or they're different than other people's genes that may predispose to disease. So there are very few single genes that are, quotes, abnormal that cause a disease. One that I can think of is Huntington's disease. If you have a particular disease, a particular gene that predisposes you to Huntington's disease, you will get Huntington's disease. Huntington's disease is an insidious neurologic condition that it starts off inapparent. People live into their 20s and 30s often, seemingly well, and then they become neurologically and mentally impaired, and they die usually by 50. That is invariable. And so by correcting that gene, one would think you could prevent Huntington's disease.
So that leads you to the notion that we could use that whole knowledge base to diagnose a problem well in advance of its showing itself, and perhaps intervene in some way to protect the individual.
That's exactly the idea. Now, the problem is there are very few, maybe 4 or 5 diseases that I'm aware of, like Huntington's disease. The genetic predisposition to diabetes, to high blood pressure, to cancer of various sorts, on and on and on, is very complex. There may be, you know, 4 or 5, 10 different genes, and even there, it's a predisposition, a risk. It doesn't mean absolutely. And so that this increased genetic risk interacts with environmental factors, such as maybe being eating too much, being overweight, smoking, things like that, or toxins, so that it becomes very complex. So then the question is, if we knew, for example, all the genes that might put us at risk for development of early dementia, Alzheimer's disease, and we corrected all those genes, would we wipe out Alzheimer's disease? And the answer is probably not.
Because of these other factors.
Because of other factors. Yeah.
But, you know, there's another issue here, and that is, should we be tampering? It's going back to this notion. For example, cloning comes to mind, and obviously that's the big bugaboo, worrying about human cloning, that we're going to be really messing with the natural order of things. And what's taken millions of years to develop in evolution, basically, I think, I saw a quote somewhere that you could change in one generation what's taken, you know, basically change the course of human evolution in one generation by using these kinds of genetic manipulations.
Yeah, that quote is from Edward O. Wilson. Some of the listeners may be familiar with E.O. Wilson's work. He is an evolutionary biologist who is from Harvard University. And in 1999, he published a book called Consilience. That, frankly, was a word I wasn't familiar with, but he chose it specifically because of its unusual, and it means bringing together or coming together. And he talks about the coming together of all kinds of knowledge, including the natural sciences, the social sciences, and the arts and humanities. But toward the end of that book, he gets into a discussion about what we're talking about, the genetic manipulation. And he says that what has taken humankind millions of years through the process of evolution to change and develop, we theoretically would have the ability to do within one or two generations by manipulating the the sperm or the egg genetically. And that's true if we all sort of got together and decided
that. And the
that.
Peril of that, it seems to me, is, you know, this whole notion of designer babies, and it, you know, do we want a boy? Do we want a girl? Mm-hmm. Do we want blue eyes? Do we want blonde hair? Mm-hmm. Do we want, how smart do they need to be? And then do we discard, you know, those embryos or those genetic components that are not desirable? So, that raises an awful lot of questions.
What you just mentioned, Linda, is a trove of discussion.
I know.
It relates to IVF or in vitro fertilization, which many of the listeners will know is very topical because last week the Nobel Prize Committee announced the naming of Robert Edwards, a British researcher, to receive the Nobel in Medicine or Physiology. For his work on IVF.
And 4 million babies later, I might add, and parents, and 8 million parents who are, you know, grateful probably, who might never have been able to have a child or able to conceive this way. So
that's the upside and what most people applaud. A controversial aspect of this is the probably close to a million plus or minus IVF embryos that are sitting in a freezer somewhere, some for years and years now, around the world, and the large majority of those will never be used. And is this right? Is this wrong? If they get thawed, they'll die. If they sit in the freezer for a long time, some of them will die. Could they be used for medical? This is at the basis of the debate about the use of embryonic stem cells. Let me just use this opportunity to define what embryonic stem cells are. Embryonic stem cells are those cells that are taken from about a 5-day-old embryo. That means 5 days after the sperm and the egg have met up. And then they start to divide, the cells divide, and you get about maybe 50 or 60 cells in that age. And so that's what we're talking about in terms of embryonic stem cells. We're not talking about aborted fetuses. There's a myth or a misconception that that embryonic stem cells come from aborted fetuses. They do not.
They come from IVF procedures.
They come from IVF procedures.
Where they only implanted some of the eggs that and sperm that were fertilized, and
that's
the others are being held in abeyance, so to speak.
That's correct.
But there's also non-embryonic stem cells that are being used as well.
Yeah, throughout our body we have various organs that proliferate rapidly. The one that most people are familiar with is the skin. know, you cut your skin, it heals very quickly, but the normal process of proliferation or regeneration of the skin goes on whether we cut ourselves or not. Same thing happens in the bone marrow and also in the lining of the gastrointestinal tract. And in each of those three organs, the bone marrow, GI tract, and the skin, there are what are called stem cells. Now, these are called adult stem cells, but they have the ability, those stem cells, to turn into, or we call it differentiate, into the specialized cells of that organ. For example, the stem cells of the bone marrow can turn into red blood cells, various kinds of white cells, and so on. They cannot turn, the stem cells of the bone marrow cannot turn into skin cells. So some of the exciting, in fact, again, this is something that was just published recently, and it's been on the popular news, about the development of adult skin cells. These are called fibroblasts. They're under the skin, actually. And regressing those fibroblasts using genetic manipulation, regressing them back so that they actually function like embryonic stem cells.
So let me just clarify for our listeners. An embryonic stem cell has the ability to then be put into a different organ,
mm-hmm, right,
and take on the characteristics of that organ, thereby healing or providing new force, new energy, or what
mm-hmm
have you,
yeah,
to that organ. So you need something that's basically almost, it's like newborn. It has no differentiation yet.
That's right.
And that's why the embryonic ones are so valuable.
Yeah.
Whereas the non-embryonic ones, as you mentioned earlier, prior to this research,
mm-hmm,
could not be necessarily used to be put into our nervous system, or if it was a skin cell, it couldn't be used to
mm-hmm
be a liver cell, for example.
That's
Is that
right.
correct?
Yeah.
But
so
now
maybe
you're
we
saying
could talk about some specific examples,
yeah,
that you've alluded to.
Yeah.
Let's say someone has is in a motor vehicle accident and they have a transection or a cutting of their spinal cord.
So they're
a very serious problem.
Quadriplegic. Yeah.
And or someone has Parkinson's disease, which is a problem in the you know, deeper recesses of the brain. Wouldn't it be nice to put some cells that haven't made up their mind yet about what kind of cells are going to be in the vicinity? And we're talking about what we call pluripotent or stem cells in the vicinity of this transected spinal cord or in the brain of a person with Parkinson's disease, let them grow into new cells and rejuvenate the organ.
So that's really the most interesting thing of all,
yeah,
is that in fact these stem cells can actually resuscitate or rejuvenate an
right
ailing organ.
That's right.
So
that's the idea.
Yeah, and in a way, would it remove the need for transplants, perhaps? Could we repair a kidney? Could we repair the heart, for example, using these stem cells?
That's a good question. We could probably repair portions of the heart and portions of the kidney. Whether we could create a brand new kidney or heart, of course, brings up the whole issue of cloning and developing new babies for purposes of cloning, which frankly, is being done.
That's a huge, huge slippery slope. Well, I know that they're using them in bone marrow transplants, cancer therapies, as you mentioned, neurological diseases, drug developments. I mean, there's a huge, huge utilization for stem cells. And the question is, how do we feel about them? But with this new research that suggests that we can actually harvest them from skin cells and then make them new to be used in these other methods is really, groundbreaking, earth-shattering news.
It is, and it is intended in some ways to remove the objection to the use of embryonic stem cells for religious and other reasons.
Well, very briefly, in the very little time we have left, what do you think the implications for our healthcare system are from all of these?
You know, people who have tried to predict the healthcare system in the past have failed, but I can see in terms of so-called personalized medicine, meaning knowing your genome and following you according to what your genome says would be your risks and so on for your whole life from the time you're born, that would put some clear additional burdens on the healthcare system. If we start cloning and we start doing stem cell implants for one thing or another, there would be those additional burdens, but then you have to factor in what burdens are we relieving.
Yeah.
If we cure someone who is quadriplegic, we might be saving the healthcare system.
So much to talk about, so much to think about. You'll have to come back. We'll have to continue this discussion. Dr. Gregory Eastwood, Professor of Bioethics and Humanities, fascinating discussion. Thanks so much for coming.
Pleasure to be here.
We have to take a short break. I'm Linda Cohen, and this is HealthLink on Air, 570 WSYO.